And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And today we're going to talk about the Kenyan elections and the International Criminal Court and the relationship between those two things. That'll be the first item. And then about the halfway point, we're going to talk to Stephen Gowans, who has written a very interesting piece. You go to gowans.wordpress.com, and he's asking whether the U.S. should bomb Syria. The answer being no, but he deals with it very straight up, as though it were the People's Republic of the United States, and what would a decent democracy-loving country do? And then advises them, and then he says they are not going to do this. Of course, it's Victoria Day, it's so-called, and of course it's peculiar. It gives everyone an opportunity to scratch their heads and ask why. In Quebec, of course, it is called Patriots Day. It's called Patriots Day in Quebec on a decision made by the Quebec government in year 2003 to honor those who in 1837 rose up in rebellion, demanding basically democracy, self-rule. And then the country went through a lot of turmoil afterward, and those of Quebec who believe in the principles of 1837 honor them every year on this date. Here in English-speaking Canada, we have Victoria Day, which honors those who put down the rebellions of 1837, which is the very least they thought they could do. We'll come back to this subject a little later. I think we're going to be talking to our guest, but actually, no, we're not. I'll let you know. Further on the Victoria Day and Patriots Day, I am really disappointed. And you know, we have a wonderful author, Margaret Atwood. She has to be one of the great worldwide, and someone who sort of understands her position in world letters and speaks out on the appropriate occasions. She fought for our libraries in Toronto, and she does a lot of really great things. But she and others, including Ms. May of the Green Party and the actor Gordon Pinsent, are calling for a change of the name Victoria Day. And their brilliant idea is to make it Victoria and First Peoples Day, I think it is. I'm going to make sure I get that right. I'll look up the words here, the appropriate ones. Well, there's a problem with that. Yes, that's what's called Victoria and First Peoples Day .ca, if you want to look them up. I'm in favor of First Nations Day. That would do it. Victoria and First Nations Day, I have a problem with. And why we can't have a Patriots Day to honor the 37 Rebellion, 37-38, basically, which was participated in by people who wanted self-rule and democracy and had to fight the crown and were hanged for their troubles, many of them, should be honored here. I don't understand why that cannot be advocated. Maybe they should. Well, we, of course, couldn't have a countrywide Patriots Day because our beloved government is monarchist to its bones. But I am glad that they're wrestling over. Holidays are great wrestling matches. They're occasion to really worry about what's become of our, what is it we're doing. Now, for example, Quebec used to celebrate what they call Dollard's Day, recognition of a sort of mythical Quebec hero. This was a man from France who had come as a frontier figure and who engaged in warfare with First Nation people and actually, happily for history, was killed. And the sort of right nationalist elements in Quebec who didn't want to celebrate Victoria Day said, well, we ought to celebrate, you see, Dollard Day. But the germ in that was that would be the old French crown and the old French system. So, and it went along for a number of years. But then the Parti Québécois, which is a social democratic party, whether anybody here likes to hear that or not, but it is. And, of course, it is a party dedicated to the defense of all the original legal and constitutional agreements with Britain and later with the Ottawa government over what Quebec is. They decided wisely to make it Patriots Day. And, by the way, the celebrations there are large and loud, and they commemorate something. See, in May of 1837, the British said to the people of Lower Canada, Quebec, no, you can't have self-rule. No, you cannot keep the taxation. In other words, if you raise the taxes, you give it to us. And don't talk about any control over the money, which, by the way, so many revolutions turn on that. The Americans had a big thing. We're not giving you the tax money. Oh, yes, you are. And it was really like the mob, right? I get 10%, no. And so that's in Quebec, that's what they did. They said, well, you know, we live here. We want more say. And the British government decided to put its foot down, probably as much as anything because they were French. They thought they had to show them. And so public meetings began to happen in May 1837 through November. Big ones, huge meetings and rallies where Mr. Papineau spoke and others. And that's a great history. Similar kinds of meetings were taking place here, William Lyon Mackenzie and others. Not on the same scale, I have to say, frankly. And that would not be natural because, after all, the French could never accept a queen or a British because they're not British. They're in English. However you want to use this, it just isn't going to work. So you're going to get more unanimity of opinion on that question than you will in English, Canada. We're quite divided over, you know, how much we are to love the queen, not whether or not to love her, but or the, you know, the royal system. How much to... And this has really stunted, frankly, democratic struggle in this in upper so-called Upper Canada, now Ontario, whatever. That was Charles Roach's last battle. For those who remember the great Charles Roach, he was trying to get this subject once again in front of the people. And here it's regarded as you're regarded as eccentric if you talk about self-rule in that way and reject the crown. But he did do it, and that struggle really ought to go on, and there should be a question raised. But I would say it's a non-starter for Margaret Atwood and Gordon Pinsent and these people. I'd say go to Quebec and have a meeting with the other patriots and hit on a formula. But if you're going to raise the issue First Nations, then knock off the name Victoria and just go with First Nations Day. And that would be great. We could have events at Queen's Park and Ottawa or right across the country where it would be strictly devoted to recognition of the First Nations and their contribution and actually also an opportunity to discuss what has happened in this wonderful relationship, which we're told. Anybody who reads this stuff will be told all these great things. I actually read something they wrote with a straight face, you know, the long and friendly relations between the British and the First Nations and the Métis. And I'm thinking, Louis Riel, anybody? that worked out. And incidentally, they don't seem to want to take credit for this, but the hanging Riel was the first moment when people saw French nationalism in Montreal, Quebec, like they'd never seen it before. Because when it came time to really punish, people said, well, you're not going to hang him. Oh, yes, the Mounties or whoever they were going to hang him, British officers and everybody. And the French said, well, don't do that. I mean, you know. We've looked at him, and of course, when he spoke, they could understand he was speaking French. They understood what he was saying. And they said, you know, he's got a case and all that. Oh, no, we have to make an example. And they said, for whom are you making this example? Well, for you, number one. Well, let me make another example. And that became really the spark that made a much more pronounced profile of French nationalism in Canada. It was thanks to Hank Avriel, which was not one of the prouder moments of the British in their relationship with Native people, because the Métis and the Native people were involved and weren't happy with the outcome. So I intend to beat this drum for a while. We need to review the 1837 rebellion in Upper Canada, and we need some occasion for it. Now, by the way, the Patriots' Day in Quebec, which falls on the same day, in other words, it's the anti-Victoria Day in Quebec, why couldn't Ontario's legislature have an 1837, you know, Patriots' Day here? I mean, just before Ontario. And I'm not saying it has to be Saskatchewan. We understand they would rather celebrate being part Texas or something. They could do whatever they want. But Ontario ought to do what Quebec did. Just say, on that day, we're going to call it so-and-so. But for the Margaret Atwood proposal, I would say just call it First Nations Day. Why would that be a great occasion? I think, by the way, I think New Zealand has such thing. New Zealand has really worked harder at resolving this issue of being white colonialists and dominating and oppressing people and destroying their culture, et cetera, and realizing the mistake than others. Because always there's the problem of ever frankly acknowledging it was somehow a mistake and rooted in racial feelings. So we're having some problems reaching Mr. Otachi. I'll just tell you offhand what we were going to talk about. We may not get him, but I'll just make it a news item. Mr. Otachi is a lawyer who represented one of the three or four, I don't remember the number, Kenyans who were charged by the International Criminal Court for election violence in Kenya. It took place in the year 2006, I believe. And it's a very suspicious indictment and charge because a leading political figure in Kenya, Uhuru Kenyatta, now the president of Kenya, was named. And every country in the world, including U.S. and Canada, experiences, you know, things like this, election violence and charges of we even in our most last federal election, there was this strange thing of the robocalls and all that. So all this is known. But for some reason, the ICC, which has only charged Africans, the only people, only individuals accused of crimes against humanity since the establishment of the International Criminal Court have been Africans. And Africans, frankly, just had enough of that. And so just prior to the election, they put Mr. Kenyatta on the spot and they said, we want you to be in court. He took a very brave and smart course, I guess, in retrospect. I didn't really think he should go, but he went. And when they got there and they went through their little exercise, charges were basically dropped against three. The other three, one of them being Mr. Otachi's client, Mr. Hussein Ali. But the one against Kenyatta still remains. And it was, you have to read it politically. I know no other way to explain this. He was the odds-on choice to lead the country. And the U.S. and Britain have a little problem with him. He's not particularly malleable. He has true political roots because his father was Jomo Kenyatta. And is basically the father of his country, a very big figure, that is, his father was. And so it makes him less pliable to the wishes of the British and the Americans. So the Americans couldn't resist saying something stupid. Just before the election, the Americans said to Kenya, if you vote for Kenyatta, there will be consequences. So the Kenyans, suffering from self-respect, they said, good. Well, let's take the consequences. And they voted for Kenyatta. I would say the threat from the British, Mr. Cameron, you know, the friend of the world's people. And if you know, the world's poor will wake up every morning and say, thank God we have a friend in Mr. Cameron of Britain. And so they tried to intimidate And it had the opposite effect. However, the charge remains over his head so that they can say, we have a hook in you, Mr. Kenyatta. We are going to convict you, or we're going to smear you, so that we always talk about you as a criminal, or perhaps a criminal, which is really dirty. I mean, here's Mr. Obama with his drones and with his wiretapping and, you know, the assortment of wars. I don't know which. Pick your favorite. And he has, by the way, as I'm speaking, 100 people in Guantanamo on hunger strike. Not exactly a daily news report from that country, from the U.S. And they want to get on Mr. Kenyatta's case. So we wanted to speak to Mr. Otachi about that, and to also to find out, get his assessment of the impact on their country of the British and U.S. involving themselves. And just one step further on that, apparently we're not going to be able to get him. I'll just tell you, the NGOs haven't really distinguished themselves. And I really hope we get to where we just say an American NGO says, a British NGO says, so we get all this clear. And if we're going to do that, if I have to hear the British NGO Amnesty or the American NGO Human Rights Watch, I want to hear from the Kenyan NGO, particularly if they've been doing any investigation or treatment of African Americans or First Nation people in the United States and Canada. I want to see their reports. Otherwise, I don't want to hear only one side. The Taylor Report, CIUT, a lot of other people devoted to the idea. There's a lot of opinions out there. Let's hear some others. Rather than suffering from NGO diktat, which you may as well be the State Department. You're listening to the Taylor Report. It's CIUT 89.5 FM, and Phil Conan is here from Cincinnati. How's Cincinnati?
Well,
we don't meet a lot of people from Cincinnati.
No, but I always enjoy going there.
What's there?
Well, what is there is the oldest choral festival of choral music in North America.
Choral?
Choral music. They have a community choir, which is now 140 years old, founded by German immigrants, the best kind of German immigrants, the 1848 immigrants. And Cincinnati has a very...
The ones who elected Lincoln.
The ones who elected, absolutely. And fought for Lincoln as well. They have there is an old German American culture to Cincinnati, and so this festival enjoys a lot of community support. And this is the 100th anniversary of the birth of the British composer Benjamin Britten, who was a pacifist and who wrote in 1962, which is just a little more than 50 years ago, a war requiem incorporating the poems of Owen and Sassoon. Wilfred Owen, the British pacifist poet who died in the last days of the First World War. It's a piece of music that is not designed to make you love war. It's a piece of music that's designed to make you abhor and be horrified by war.
Yes. He's the one who, as I recall the poem, said, here I am trying to kill a man with a bayonet. We're fighting to the death. If I were to meet him on the street, I'd buy him a drink.
Yes, yes. And he's the same guy. Same guy. Yes, it's a very. Of course, he's not a great cultural.
Also, pardon me?
He's not a great cultural hero to certain types of British people.
Yeah, by the way, he actually is a great poet, but suffers from the problem of the certain people not wanting to hear his message.
Yes,
and so they sniff about his qualities as a poet, right. Which is just
and also his qualities as a fudging. Human too. I mean, anything they could. But anyway, it was a very striking performance, and I thought the audience was profoundly moved by it. And I just wish people should hear this kind of music more often, because it is designed to make you horrified, right? And it's which I think is the proper response to war. And Britain refused to fight. He did alternative service. But he wouldn't serve in the army. He says, I'm not going to go kill anybody.
Yes, well, that's very much to his credit. There's another one. I talked earlier at length about Victoria Day, but this thing of always trying to peg, when did we become a country? Well, we became a country when we slaughtered ourselves on the mountain somewhere in West Europe. That's when we began. No, it was when we went over and killed the Boers. That was when we became. It was at. They're always picking out a battle. It's all bunk, total bunk. Nothing to do with anything But, you know, just, you know, a way to see. Let's see if we can fool a few more suckers to put on a uniform and go get shot for us. So, you know, very unhelpful. But it goes on. Hey, I have an item. We're a little later, of course. I'm going to tell you, remind you, we're going to be talking to Steve Gowans about the Syria matter, which is a very important one. But I have something. And Phil, you and I have talked about this before, but I have it in my hand now to document this story of Jackie Robinson, and I'm now turning it into the Brothers Robinson. I want a novel, then I want a film, and I want everything else. Because the film, unfortunately, focuses on the hero who happens to be the white cigar-chomping owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers who brings Jackie Robinson into baseball. Did anybody hear the segue from what we were talking about? Me either. Anyway, in checking out the story, I have a New York Times article about Jesse's brother, Mack Robinson, who finished second to Jesse Owens in the Olympics, and who my lead into this is that in the movie, Jackie's wife says to him as they enter a southern town and see the signs of segregation, she says, "We're not in Pasadena anymore." That got me, as they say, steamed up. So I checked out, remembering the story of Mack, the brother, and here's how it goes. Robinson, who was known as Mack, also broke the Olympic mark with a time of 21.1 seconds. 1936 Olympics, he finished second. He was overshadowed by Owens, much as his accomplishments have been overshadowed by those of his younger brother Jackie, the Hall of Famer, who broke baseball's color barrier. A track star at Pasadena City College in California, Mack Robinson could not afford the trip to New York for the Olympic trials, so a group of local businessmen raised $150 for his train fare. Robinson had no coach, and he qualified for the 200 in the same battered pair of spikes he had worn during the college track season. He ran a sensational race in Berlin, although his shoes continued to deteriorate. He nipped at Owens' heels and finished 4/10 of a second behind. And the fact that he finished 4/10 of a second behind gnawed at him. And this is his daughter. Daddy always thought if he had better shoes or some decent coaching, he could have beaten Jesse or made it even closer than it was, his daughter Kathy Robinson Young said. The silver medal meant little in Pasadena, a city Robinson compared to the Jim Crow South. I don't think that made it into the movie 42. The Jim Crow South. If anybody in the quotes, if anybody in Pasadena was proud for me, other than my family and close friends, he once said, they never showed it. The only time I was noticed was when somebody asked me during an assembly at school if I'd race against a horse. And, you know, we laugh, but I remember Johnson, our sprinter, who was brought down racing against a horse. Somebody ought to look into to study white people. There is a couple of books now trying to figure out white people. They want to see a black man run against a horse. Robinson, back to the text. Robinson was reduced to pushing a broom, sweeping downtown streets while wearing his Olympic sweatshirt with a big USA on the front, unable to afford new clothes. Racial conflict cost him that job, too. When a judge ordered the desegregation of public swimming pools in Pasadena, the city retaliated by firing all its black workers, including Robinson. Jackie Robinson was 17 when his brother took the silver in Berlin, and his anger over Mack's treatment stoked a lifelong grudge against his hometown. Mack Robinson wound up working in baseball as an usher at Dodger Stadium. He would sneak family into the blue level, recalled Young, referring to the good seats. But he found his calling as a truant officer for John Muir High School in Pasadena and in speaking out against local youth street crime. I like this. He was very strict. Very strict, Young said. But he was generous when it came to Muir football games. Daddy would flash his pass to get us in, she said. And any kids hanging around at the gate, he'd sweep them all in, 20 or so at times, saying, "They're with me." One of us got a phone call, but that's okay. After decades of being ignored by his city and his country, Mack Robinson was chosen to be part of a group that carried a giant Olympic flag into the opening ceremony of the 1984 Olympics at Los Angeles Coliseum. It was his greatest moment, Young said. In 1997, Pasadena honored the Robinson brothers by unveiling 9-foot-high bronze sculptures of their heads across the street from City Hall. When they were building them, Young said, that's the daughter, I used to go down and take pictures of the two heads, Jackie's and Daddy's, lying on a flatbed truck. Boy, there's a picture I'd like to see. The inscription under Mack Robinson's statue speaks of a life that was scarcely defined by his race in Berlin. It reads, athletes should recognize that once they establish themselves, people will attempt to pattern their lives after their sports heroes. As Young said, I am just as proud of his achievements with the youth of Pasadena as I am of his athletic achievements. That's the story of Jackie Robinson's brother, Mac. His real name was Matthew. Now, you know, if you're going to talk about Jackie and you're going to use a line like that, oh, we're not in Pasadena, the line from Jackie should have been, oh, yes, we are.
did Mac's name come up in the movie at all in 42?
I didn't see it.
Oh, you haven't seen it. Okay.
I reserve the right to attack films I don't see. Yeah. I will go and see it. But I know that if you put a white movie star in a film and a black star that is not known, that it's going to be about the white star. I do know that.
I'd like to know whose leg you think you're pulling.
You know, that's what I.
By the way, I haven't seen a single review of the film which mentioned Mack Robinson.
I'm also tired of hearing that Pee Wee Reese went over to him, put his arm around his. You know, okay, that's nice. But that isn't the man who took all that was Jackie. You know, he's the one who got beaned. He's the one who got insulted. And now we have to have a statue of him and Pee Wee Reese together.
Spiked was another really nasty thing where if you're playing third base, some guy slides into you his shoes up.
A very famous one named Enos Slaughter.
Yeah.
From St. Louis, by the way.
Right, yeah.
And Enos Slaughter reserved to be, you know, the right to be what he was. And was unreconstructed. Anyways, there's a lot of that story is very important. Can't repeat it enough. I want to make sure I announce Wednesday, May 22, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at a different book list. That's at 746 Bathurst Street. It's going to be a talk. Really, it'll probably go right over my head. But ethno-mathematics. That's because anything mathematics go over my head. Ethno-mathematics, challenging Eurocentrism in math education by Professor Marilyn Frankenstein. Professor Frankenstein is a professor at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, who has taught courses in quantitative reasoning and this is a great title, debt and taxes. What do we owe each other, among others? She will demonstrate the importance of quantitative reasoning to our understanding of a more just world, and that all of us can understand and reason quantitatively. Oh, that's a challenge to me. So Professor Frankenstein is the author of Ethno-Mathematics, Challenging Eurocentrism in Mathematics and Education. Again, that's Wednesday, May 22, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at a different book list, 746 Bathurst. By the way, they had a great meeting on Friday, if you missed it, on race and revolution, lessons from Cuba, and Professor Keith Ellis. Professors Keith Ellis and Isaac Sandy were there. I think we'll get a review of it. Maybe we can catch up with Professor Ellis and just have him talk straight out about this subject. And you're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. It's the Taylor Report, and we're going to take a little break, come back. We hope to be talking to Steve Gowans.